Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I am representing the political center and have on the right co-host Dan McKay. Welcome, Senator.
Good morning, everybody.
And on the left, Councilwoman Shireen Gorbani. Welcome, Shireen.
Hello, and hello to our listeners.
I want to talk first about Trump's Tulsa rally. In an event that was so predictable, Dan and Shireen, and I say that because you knew this was going to focus on numbers. You knew it was going to be how many attended. The fire department, I guess, estimated that there were about 6,200 in attendance. It's less than a third of what the arena would seat. There were tales of there being up to 1 million people coming. They had all these seats set up and video screens outside the arena. I'm sure Donald Trump is internally just going ballistic with his campaign team. Dan?
Well, you know, and you heard also reports that went along with, like, at least my daughter told me about it because I'm not that up on TikTok, but apparently there were tutorials for people to go and troll the president to, like, reserve all these tickets to, like, you know, take up that type of deal. I don't know how much of that really mattered, but it just shows, despite how confident people want to portray that, you know, hey, we can restart this economy, we can do all these other things in the midst of the COVID, that society is like taking smaller steps moving forward than people want to believe. You have the rioters on one end, and then you have the you know, the let's open the economies on the other end. And then you have the mass of America just saying, I don't know about this. I'm not sure. And I probably chalk more of the poor attendance up to that than anything else. But, you know, we'll never know. And it didn't look good to see all those empty seats when the president thought that the entire city was going to be overrun. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, he's such a crowd counter. Shireen, not only was the crowd disappointing, but he talked about the Kung flu, the Chinese virus. He asked people to slow the testing down and obviously missed a major opportunity to help unify and heal the country during a global and national crisis.
Yeah, that's because he's bad at his job. And it's interesting because now he's going back to his classic hits, right? He's frankly given up on responding to coronavirus, to meeting the moment that we're in with the racial strife in our country. He didn't mention it at all. But I think there's actually another thing happening here that's really interesting to look at side by side. This was Trump's rally. It was poorly attended. It was not well organized. The turnout was nothing like they thought it would be. And then he had a rally in Arizona organized by another group, not his campaign, that was quite full, a very dangerous situation, a lot of people indoors yelling. But to see the failure of his campaign, I think, is something that was frankly quite welcome from my eyes. I was happy to see them not be able to pull it off. But I do think that there are going to continue to be gatherings like this, especially considering the fairly successful rally that he had in Arizona, not organized by his campaign.
You know, it highlights something, Natalie, and I'm sure, Shireen, you can do this as well, that unless you've been a political candidate or, you know, or even a party event organizer where you send out a mass invite to all these people. And I tell you this just as a very quick personal story, but I remember I got home from my mission and my mom invited all of my friends who were like off at college to come over for a return home in November. Well, they were all at college and my mom didn't really understand that very much. She ordered a 6-foot sub to have like all these people that were gonna come. And we had 3 people come. So the 3 of us ate a 6-foot sub. I still can't eat 6 sub sandwiches since that moment. So I just say, this is why I dread throwing events, because you never know what's going to, like, who's going to show up. So anyway, here you go.
Yeah. Dan, let's stay with you, though, because it was a really tough week for the president. And another thing at the top of the list was the release of the John Bolton book. I know I've followed John Bolton for many, many years. He's a foreign policy hawk. He's a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's really liked by the conservative movement. He worked in the Bush White House, in the Reagan White House, in fairly prominent positions. And he has essentially said that this president is not capable of doing the job, Dan. I don't know if you've watched the interviews, but we now have a string of very high-profile, important conservatives who have been on the inside who are challenging this president. And it feels to me like a turning point.
Well, okay. I will just say that there is a lot of what I like to call bitter ex-lovering going on. You know, people get in and they're there and they're doing the job and they, you know, get asked to leave or they do whatever. And then immediately on their way out, they holler and scream about, you know, the competency of their old employer. I've seen it time and time again. Now, the question is, what's the percentage of those that are doing it after this president? It seems to be an inordinate number compared to previous presidents, but that's just me.
Yeah. Shereen, love to hear you talk here, but you get the easy job, honestly, to take on this president.
I'll just repeat what Dan just said. It seems like an inordinate amount of people with this president. And again, I just can't emphasize enough the chaos of this administration, the lack of follow through on really big efforts that seem to start moving, the complete lack of coherency around his foreign policy. There's just piece after piece after piece that show that he's just deeply unfit for this office.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be a theme.
I'm not going to let that rest there. I'm just going to say, look, I understand. But when he's reelected in November...
So you understand he's unfit for office?
No, I understand your feelings.
Something else.
I get where you're coming from, right? But I will look back and I will say...
It's not good for your party either.
In November, and I will say, when he's reelected, we're still going to have all of these conversations about how, you know, how the America can move forward. And honestly, I'm kind of sick of all of it. I'm just going to say this, you know, we're on the air, whole deal. I'm just kind of sick of everything right now. You know, you've got all of the COVID related stuff. You've got the race, you know, issues that are going on in this country. You go down the list and I am just like, if you could see my hands, which, you know, we are on a Zoom call, so you guys can, but I'm like way over the top sick of all of this stuff. And I was talking to a friend last night and this person is, you know, likes to pay attention to local events and, you know, even national and political stuff. It's like, I've turned it off.
Yeah.
I've turned it off. And I think more and more America, as much as, you know, we are paying attention, I think more and more America, to maintain their health and sanity, is actually distancing themselves from all of this stuff.
I would say on the other side, I can't imagine a more incredible time to be a public servant. The kinds of community work that's happening, the kinds of difficult conversations we're having at so many levels, the way that I think coronavirus in particular has laid bare so many of the problems that we had in our society, compounded then and further exposing our racial infrastructure, our systemic racism by actually seeing and starting to confront some of our deeply broken systems, especially for people of color in our community. And yesterday I got the opportunity to tour the airport. And so while all this is happening, we still see work going on, things moving forward, progress happening. And it was such an incredible experience. And of course, the economic aspect of it is really interesting, too. The whole project is a $4 billion project. $1 billion of those dollars have come back into workers and contractors on the Wasatch Front. And to kind of see all of these like difficult, complicated, challenging issues in our hands, that we have the opportunity to start changing things and do things differently or improve where there's opportunity for improvement, I think is a really, it's a moment that's calling on people's grit and their resilience in a way that I don't know that there's been a time like that before recently.
Shereen, I think you've stated that really well. And I want to, from the political middle, just agree with both of you, Dan. Like, I like what you said about how people have tuned out. I think that's very true. I think it's a coping mechanism. And it's not just tuning out, you know, all the Trump news, but it's tuning out the coronavirus news that just, I mean, are you guys just so tired of this? You know, I'm so ready for life again. And then to you, Shereen, what an opportunity for rebirth. And I hope it happens. Before we go to the next segment, I want to just ask you about this controversy in Kentucky where they have slashed 95% of the polling places ahead of the primary election. That means they're going from 3,700 to fewer than 200. The voting rights activists are just going nuts about this. Shireen, what other color commentary should we give our listeners? Seems to me like a pretty problematic situation they have.
Yeah, and if you haven't had a chance to see some of the footage of people lined up, they locked the doors, pounding on the doors to get in to vote, especially in, actually, I believe it was in Lexington. Anyway, there's incredible footage of people really demanding their right to vote. They had reduced polling places specifically in areas where they had large African-American communities just down to one polling place. And I watched this woman because the candidates filed an injunction. People were able to come in and vote after 6 o'clock. And this woman was there with her 18-year-old daughter sobbing, just saying this isn't how it should be in this country. And nothing could be a bigger call for vote by mail.
Dan?
Well, it is, you know, it is tough trying to figure out how to balance what the tradition is of people's voting and the fact and the fiction of, you know, vote by mail and some of these other components. I've been voting from by mail for so long that I guess I don't really know, you know, why people are so concerned about it. But I'll say, you know, we've got to do what we can to make sure that despite, you know, the virus and all the things that are going on, we've got to find a way to keep the country and, you know, and its core tenets, which is voting. We got to keep it available to people. And I don't know. I wasn't there. I would just say I'm hopeful that, you know, I had someone complain to me yesterday that they won't be able to, you know, show up and vote on the same day. You know, they have to mail in a ballot and they're frustrated about that. This person likes to get the most information and then vote and show up and vote that day. I get it.
A really quick plug. This year, you can mail in your ballot on Election Day. It has to be postmarked on Election Day. Previously, you had to get it in the mail the day before. But I think in the wisdom of our legislature, they decided, words I don't say often, so alert to everyone, they decided that you can mail in your ballot on Election Day. And I think that's really exciting. So don't forget to get your ballot in postmarked by Tuesday, June 30th.
That's a compliment for you, Dan. I'm with Shireen Gourvani and Dan McKay. I'm Natalie Gochner. In our next segment, we're going to talk about Dr. Angela Dunn's memo about the coronavirus. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourvani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and we are talking about public issues affecting the state of Utah. And I want to go right to Dr. Angela Dunn's memo, whatever you want to call it, summary of the risk the state faces right now with the COVID-19 counts, hitting a really high level and in a way that I guess is predictable given the way that a lot of people aren't following the public health guidelines. I'm sure this is a frustration to Governor Herbert, not just the memo, but more the way people are not following the guidance that he's put out. I think you're going to see a really big push, Dan and Shireen, over the next 5 days to get this state to behave when it comes to social distancing and face coverings. Because at least according to Dr. Dunn, we're just maybe 4 to 6 weeks out from some pretty serious hospital constraints. Shireen?
You think it's going to be in the next 5 days or maybe 5 days or so after that? I'm curious about how politicized this is.
It's got to happen now.
I agree.
Yeah, it's got
to
happen
now. Yeah. So I think we're on a really concerning trajectory. I think it's important for people to understand the kind of fear and anxiety that people felt back in March as the kind of all of this was ramping up, that you're more likely to get COVID-19 now. So the measures that you took to, you know, practice good hand washing, social distancing, wearing a mask, please keep that up. It keeps so many members of our community safe. And there's a lot you can do personally to really turn this around. I, of course, would like to see, a number of different interventions, but we actually can. And you've said this so many times, Natalie, the answer to the economic crisis in a public health crisis is to get the public health aspect right. We have to stay focused on that.
Yeah, if you're opposed to a shutdown, wear a mask.
Yep.
Dan?
Okay, maybe it's because I played tennis for 2 hours this morning and I'm tired. But I'm a little bit cranky, I guess, maybe is the right way to say it. Why is wearing a mask like becoming a political thing? Like, you know, somebody the other day, posted on Facebook, I refuse to go to Costco because they're requiring me to wear a mask. My first thought was, thank goodness, less people at Costco. So I was happy about that, made my line shorter. But the second thing that I was like, man, why is this an issue? Why is caring about the health for someone else, why is that a problem? Like, it blows my mind that is becoming like this political statement. And by the way, it's not a partisan political statement, because I ran through footage of the riots. Guess what? It is like 10 to 1, the number of masks being worn by people who are protesting or whatever it might be. And so this is not like a partisan thing. We have got to like just step up and say, hey, in the morning I take my vitamins and on my way out the door I grab my mask. Like,
hey, Dan, it's a great point, but would it not help to have the leader of the Republican Party in this country put on a mask and take away that partisan difference? I gotta throw that out there because, you know, I give so much credit to our leaders, President Adams, Speaker Wilson, both the lieutenant governor and the governor. They have adopted the mask routine, and there's a real simple reason why they have. It's very inexpensive and very efficacious or effective.
Harm reduction.
Let's find one more thing to blame on the president. It's all his fault. It would be, you know, if he did it, then I'm certain all the Democrats would totally fall in line and follow the example of Donald Trump by wearing a mask.
But I feel like
I don't know what I was thinking.
I feel like what you're suggesting, Dan, is that leadership doesn't matter.
No, I think what I'm saying is at the end of the day, we all need to take personal responsibility for our community, for our health, and for all of those things. My wife and I had a very in-depth conversation last night. I do not want to get COVID-19. I really don't. Like, I'm hesitant for several reasons, right? And all of the descriptions from it sound horrible. So I have a pretty limited social circle, you know, and, you know, this last legislative session, everybody wanted to get together I sat in this office and I was one of the few, you know, in the legislature who stayed here. And despite the fact that the Capitol's closer to me than it is to most of the other rest of the legislature, it's not that leadership doesn't matter. It certainly does. Okay. But we cannot turn it like health and like caring about one another and that kind of stuff. We cannot make it become a political statement. It's stupid. So there you go.
This is a rant I can get on.
Well, Dan and Shereen, Dan mentioned the comment personal responsibility, and we have quite a battle building up in our state between mandating masks and just encouraging masks. And of course, Salt Lake City Mayor, Salt Lake County Mayor have been very vocal about asking Governor Herbert to make it mandatory. He's not gone there. Shereen, I'm wondering what you would advise and the rationale for that. And then let's ask Dan the same question.
Yeah, so I think this is another example where I get really conflicted and frustrated with the state's attitude generally that, you know, local control is best and we want to push decisions down to where they're best made. And then pieces of legislation come through that really preempt local health authorities from being able to make the right decisions that fit their environment. The COVID-19 experience across the state is not consistent. It's different where we have more densely populated communities than it is out in our rural counties. In one of the early special sessions, the authority of health departments was significantly curtailed. And so many people have been calling on us, on, you know, County Mayor Wilson to be more aggressive as we're seeing numbers spike in our county. We actually do not have the power to do that. We have to go to the state legislature and ask them to be able to, a real mother may I situation, can we please take efforts to protect our community? We have a lot of work to do. And I think it's important to also say that what we're asking for is not that masks mandatorily be worn outside. No one's going to get arrested for this. It is another tool in the toolbox to really encourage and to have an expectation. You will come if you are coming into grocery stores, if you're coming into places where you cannot be more than 6 feet apart, that you will wear a mask. And we are doing this. And I need people to understand this. The reason that this matters so much is this is a hug between you and your grandchild. This is seeing your neighbor and, you know, your child, your friend, not get COVID-19. Many people are fine. We understand that. But a lot of people, especially individuals with compromised health, people living with disabilities, are in a high-risk category. 163 Utahns have lost their lives. Those are people who often had to die alone because of this disease. We're talking about Zoom funerals. This doesn't have to happen. And please, and the thing that's been so hard about this is people saying, you know, don't tell me what to do. I wear a mask everywhere I go. And then I say, fine, move on. We're not talking to you. You're not going to have a problem in this system. This is a simple way that we can turn what's happening with our trajectory. Our curve is not flat. It's moving in the wrong direction. And if we take some good actions now, then we're talking about going back to school in the fall. Then we're talking about reopening our economy more safely. But the other thing, and I'm guessing you already saw this, but we need to be preparing for the second wave. Mike Leavitt was testifying, I guess, just yesterday on the steps that we need to be taking now to be prepared for what is, but has the high potential to be, a very dark winter.
Yeah. Dan, personal responsibility versus requiring masks be worn in indoor settings around a lot of people where you can't have social distancing. Where do you stand?
I personally would not like mandates, because I think once you have a mandate, you're going to have a revolt. And I think the people are literally on a tipping point on a regular basis on a lot of these issues. It's sad, but there's a tipping point. And I think that if you add mandates to it, I think we're going to see a revolt. One.
Yeah.
Two. And I'm going to be very critical of the governor's office here, because honestly, there's a lot of mistakes being made, but one of them was made in the very beginning. The governor decided in the very beginning that the COVID response was going to be a political response and was going to be a trophy show. And so at the end of the day, he marched his lieutenant governor, who was running for governor, out there in front of everybody to be like the leader of the COVID task force. And I will tell you, a lot of our responses as a state, it is constantly being weighed against the political cost of what is happening in the lieutenant governor's race. And if I know people, you know, want to think, hey, we're going to make good decisions. I am telling you, if this was not happening in election year, if this was 1 year from now and the governor had 3 years of runway, I think this would be a much different discussion here in the state of Utah. But because it is an election year, it is, in my opinion, a mess.
Hey, we're running out of time, and I have two more quick issues I want to bring up. Dan, I want to give you and your colleagues huge kudos for a wonderful, massive special session last week where you guys did some incredible heavy lifting. $20 million in housing aid, where you changed the rules to make it helpful. $60 million in grants for rental assistance. A $62 million grant program to help our cultural core, their tourism sector. Subsidies for retraining the workforce. I just thought the special session was a masterstroke, and I just want to congratulate you for that.
Well, thanks. I will say it was a very long day, and in some ways felt like the last day of a legislative session where we were literally back and forth trying to just hammer out details. I'm really grateful, honestly, to leadership in both the House and the Senate. This was a lot of work, and there were a lot of people at the table, and thanks, Natalie, for recognizing it. It was
Shereen, I don't know if you want to comment briefly on that, but I thought it was a significant policy session.
She already said the legislature's wise.
I did one time, and I'm going to take it back some other day. But today you can have it.
Okay, that's great. Then the last thing before we go to gripes, that Dan and Shereen, we're seeing a lot of GOP crossover voters, and I think that estimate is somewhere between 50 to 70,000 people have registered as Republicans for the primary election, which is a week or so away. Wow. Shireen?
So I will just say, and this actually maybe is my gratitude as well. I have a lot of gratitude for the county clerk's office. Clerks across our entire state are doing a lot of work to make sure that people get ballots in the mail. Again, you can postmark it on election day. That's different. If you are a person who needs ADA assistance to vote, please call your local clerk's office and they will get you an audio ballot. They will get you the ability to vote.
Dan, I'm going to ask you to turn that into a gripe or a gratitude.
Yeah, real quickly, I would just say, I think it's important that we recognize it takes a lot to build something, and we all stand on the shoulders of giants in this country, right? And the tearing down of all of this stuff in America is just killing me. So that's my gripe today.
I'm going to say everyone vote. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. The program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, and stay safe.